Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 127games.com.
Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode 98, Battleground Games and Hobbies. For a long time, listeners have asked me when this episode would be releasing. You see, it was recorded way back in 2011, I believe. It is a very special episode for quite a few reasons. A friend of mine at the time allowed us to record this episode at his house. My guests, Drew McCarthy, Derek Lloyd, owner of Battlegrounds, and Chase Laquadara, manager of Battlegrounds' Plainville location, along with yours truly, sat around Drew's dining room table. With a single microphone, we discussed all things Battleground. Now, for the very first time, you can hear the true story of Battlegrounds' founding as told by its owner, Mr. Derek Lloyd, and Derek's right-hand man, Chase. Don't forget that you can obtain the show notes by going to wargamingforums.com/WR98. That's right, wargamingforums.com/WR98. Put that into your favorite web browser and you'll get all that you need. So without further ado, I hope that you will enjoy this very special and lengthy episode of Wargaming Recon. And don't forget, we're just ever so closer to episode 100. So thank you for your time, and I'm sure you are going to enjoy episode 98, Battleground Games and Hobbies.
Hello, and welcome to a very special episode. Today we're joined by my friend and sometimes co-host and host of his own show, Drew McCarthy. Drew, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm rested this time. So,
you mean there's not going to be any crappiness?
Well, I can't make any promises, but we'll keep it to a minimum.
Okay. This episode is the one I've been talking about for a long time. I've been looking forward to it for ages, and I know a lot of you have been asking us to get this on the road and going, so I want to say that very happy to say that we're joined today by two guys we've known for quite a while. They are involved with the Battleground Games and Hobbies in Abington and Plainville, Mr. Derek Lloyd and Chase Laquadara. How are you guys today?
Doing well. Doing well.
Doing very well. Looking forward to it.
That's not what I heard a little while ago, Mr. I'm nervous.
Well, yeah.
So what's a gorilla?
I don't do these often.
Do you do these ever?
No. Not ever.
He's worried that anything we say could be used against us in the future.
Yeah,
so.
That's right.
Well, be careful.
But we're the person editing the podcast. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah,
right. Really, it's no different than being at the store. Anything you say is usable against you at any time.
And often it is. Yeah, it usually is.
I guess the only difference is with this, and I don't know about people who listen to No Badger, No Gnome, or will be, but a lot of people who listen to my show are overseas, so if they're going to use things against you, you're probably not going to know about it.
I mean, yeah, that's true.
When's the last time you were in New Zealand or England or something?
I was actually there last week.
Were you really?
Yeah, I have several game stores over there that we also run clandestine.
Yeah, we travel all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, for the people who don't know, we mentioned about Battleground Games and Hobbies. Derek, as the owner, why don't you tell us about it? What is Battleground Games and Hobbies?
Well, Battleground is a sort of a unique retail store. Stores like it are kind of few and far between. We specialize in role-playing games, card games, board games, miniature games, and we run tournaments for all these said games. And I think what makes the store unusual is that, probably somewhere in the vicinity of 80% or more of our retail space is entirely given over to, free tables people can come and use anytime to sit at and, meet their friends and play in our tournaments or play casually, stuff like that. It's pretty unusual, I think, for any retail store to offer so much of its space just for customers to use, freely whenever they want.
Yeah, because that doesn't, you have space, any store does, and you have to have some sort of return on investment on it, and that directly doesn't earn you any money. I mean, indirectly, I'm sure it earns a fair sum of it, But, like, it's not paying for itself by being just there.
Right, right. It's all, you know, the entire thing sort of depends upon the community that we've built at the store, or our two stores now. We have our original store in Abington that's been there since 2002. And we recently opened up our second store in Plainville, and that was last September. So we're coming up close to our one-year anniversary there. In both locations, you know, you cannot separate the success of the store from the community that's built or is building at the new location. You know, most of the people who are regulars there, it's pretty nice to see the level of loyalty that does come from a lot of the regulars who hang out there all the time, you know, who buy from you, over, say, you know, deep discounters online. They you know, see the value, in what we provide and help to support us, which is great.
I think that's necessary because without it, we wouldn't be here.
Yep. It's a nice symbiotic relationship. So hopefully that continues.
So going back to 2002, the first Battleground opened, and what led you to open a game store? It's kind of an unusual thing for someone to open.
Yeah, I was in a sort of a unique position to do it when I did do it. I had a really good job. I was working as a web developer for a company in Boston, and I had been there for many years and was pretty secure. I just was in a spot where I felt like I could take a shot on something and, you know, try to do something that I had always wanted to do. So with a lot of support from my girlfriend at the time, my wife today, she sort of tricked me into doing it, and here I am. So, but I'm glad I did. It's been an incredible experience and a lot of nice plans for the future that hopefully we can see them come to light.
And then how did the location in Plainville come about?
Well, Chase and I looked really hard trying to find a location that was, you know, far enough away from Abington where we wouldn't compete with ourselves, and also try to find a spot that, you know, wouldn't be in direct competition with other game stores. You know, so we put together a map of areas that we thought would be a good strategic place to go, and Plainville seemed to be like a decent spot. It's nestled between a lot of, you know, more densely populated areas like Attleboro, but where it's located has that nice small town kind of feel to it. Also, it's next to an incredible pizza place, which may have been the real decision. Paizoni's is right in our strip plaza, which is, it's been very convenient to have that right next door. So yeah, we're pretty happy with it. You know, the space is really nice. It's a beautiful spot. I mean, lots of game stores you go into, you know, anybody who goes to game stores with any regularity knows that a good deal of them can be very dungeon-like, and we've always strived to avoid that kind of feel. We want a clean store that, you know, has lots of space, that's comfortable and good AC and good heat in the winter, and try to avoid that really dungeon-y feel that a lot of game stores tend to have.
Yeah, I can think of quite a few, I'm sure the rest of you can.
Oh, yeah.
We won't name names.
No, I mean, I
You can if you want to, but I won't.
So, Chase, you've known Derek for quite a while. Why don't you tell us about how you guys met and explain how all this works.
So I came home from college in the summer of 2004, and one of the first things that I did in the past when I had a lot more time was just immediately go to my father's house on the Cape. And I got there, and my youngest brother, Cale, and a group of his friends had just got a new game. It was the MechWarrior Clicks game from WizKids a while back. And they were playing it just on the floor. They had mapped out like a 3x3 area with masking tape, and they were using like shoes and like paper towel rolls as terrain and stuff like that. Just, you know, sort of slogging through the rules. Like, they had their rule books open, looking at their different figures and everything else. And I was just watching TV. I feel like I was watching The Shawshank Redemption with my aunt or something like that. And
good, like, movie, good choice.
I keep looking down because there was like five or six of them just trying to figure through the game. I just get, like, I found that my attention was focused almost entirely on that the whole time. So I picked up the rule book, started going through, and started correcting them on rules and getting called names, which was typical. So after that weekend, they decided that they wanted to go buy some more figures. So we had sort of figured it out. Hale couldn't drive at the time, I feel like. He couldn't drive at the time. So he and his friends had me bring them to the place where they had played Yu-Gi-Oh! Growing up, which was Battleground in Abington. So the first time I ever went into the store was so that they could buy more MechWarrior Clicks.
Okay.
So I met Derek then. I also met Steve D. I don't know, maybe we can get into that later on.
Steve D's a topic in and of himself.
It's an awesome story.
So yeah, you know, I had a brief conversation with him. I forget what, and I remember my buying habit at the time. Like I ended up buying some booster packs of Midgoria Eclipse, and I went up and I bought like two or three, and then I opened them up, and then I went and I got one more, and I opened that up, and then I got one more, and I opened that up. So now looking back on that, I was like, that's exactly what I want to see.
You know?
Like, I didn't know. So anyhow, we started coming around to do various things, and you know, I found that they were playing like a nightly D&D game or a weekly D&D game every Monday. And, I sort of started hanging around because it was an interest of mine in high school. And then at college, I didn't really play much at all and sort of lost interest, but it was neat to see, especially the way the game was being run. Maybe we can get into that some other time.
What edition was that? Was that,
it was
third?
3.5, I think. Yeah.
Yep.
I think that was world's largest.
That was going on, yeah.
Yeah, it was World's Largest Dungeon, yeah.
I remember meeting you.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It was one of the World's Largest Dungeon, not to get off track, was one of the biggest worst things that we ever tried to do at the store.
I loved it.
The best and worst thing. Yeah, it was the best and worst thing.
I loved it. Yeah, why was it the best and worst thing?
I loved it too. It was the best thing in that it had, all right, so just in brief, the World's Largest Dungeon was a product put out by a company called, I think it was AEG. They did this gigantic book that was purported to be the largest dungeon ever made. And it probably was. It was this, you know, gigantic poster map. When you folded them all out and saw how they connected, it was like you couldn't fit them on the floor of the store when we moved all the tables. It was so big.
Yeah.
And we're talking this regular size, you know, graph, you know. So we decided we wanted to run some kind of epic event. Because role-playing games have always been a really big thing about what we're doing, and it's what got me into the hobby in the first place. I've been, I'm 40 now this year, coming up on 40 next Christmas season, and I've been playing D&D since I was probably 9 or 10. So you know, that's a pretty long time, and it's sort of like these epic ideas end up growing and festering in the heads of anybody that plays D&D for any length of time. And we decided to try to do this gigantic event where it would be. Four teams of seven players on each team. They would all take turns playing one Monday every month. So that meant I had to be there every Monday to run a game for a different group. And we cycled through the four groups. And they would all, you know, sort of like bamf into the dungeon. And they would have an allotted time. I think we played for like 4 hours. And they, you know, did as much as they could do within that four-hour time span. And then they would, you know, bamf back out into stasis. And the following week, the next group would come in and they would appear in the dungeon wherever they last left off. So it was somewhat competitive, and the different groups sort of spread out into different areas of the dungeon. So in theory, it sounds like a really fun kind of idea, except in practice, what it really meant was the enormous amount of dedication that had to go into the thing on my part, where I had to be ready for a game every single Monday night for a dungeon that was so large that had we still continued it, we would still be playing it, based on the estimation of how it was. We would probably finish sometime in 2013. So imagine, if you will, never missing a Monday night from, say, 2005 to 2013. I mean, it's just impossible. Like, it couldn't be done. I was the only DM, and it got to be too big, too much, and also several groups really sort of branched apart in power, where we had one of four groups that could basically take all three of the other groups combined. You know, no question about it. They would just annihilate the other groups if it happened to come to a fight between them. So, you know, they were sort of plowing through the dungeon, and the other three were varying levels of power. And some of them, I think Drew's group did a wonderful job of blundering into trouble all the time.
Sounds like Drew.
Kind of fun.
That was our signature.
So at a certain point, we just realized that it had gotten a little bit too big for itself, and we closed it down before I completely went insane. That was the World's Largest Dungeon. So, but since then, I've sort of, you know, tortured myself with ideas of how we could do something in the future that would capture the coolness of it without the work. I guess I'm just a glutton for punishment.
Yeah, you are.
Maybe I can find somebody else to run it and I'll just watch.
You want the coolness?
Chase, what are you doing on Monday nights for the next 25 years?
That's not happening.
Well, I mean, you were playing in it, Chase. So
no,
you must have some
luck. Yeah, so that's... I actually didn't play in it. No. I started coming around that summer, and they were playing in it. And I met a bunch of people. I saw D&D. It was cool. Like, I ended up hanging out. I ended up, you know, going behind the screen and looking to see what was coming up next. And I've just always really been interested in how people handle certain things, in D&D specifically. So it gave me everything that I wanted. I got to not be involved, and I got to watch as everything happened, just hang out at the store with people that I liked. And, you know, it was pretty awesome. Derek was the only one that didn't like it.
I was the only one.
Well, you were doing all the hard work.
Yeah, I mean, every other group, like, you know, they only had to be there. They were dedicating one Monday a month. So to them, it seems like no big deal.
Yeah,
like, what's the big deal? You just show up one Monday a month. But it was like every Monday for me. Although Chase, I think, came every Monday just to watch these guys smash around into each other.
Chase was there every Monday. Yeah. And the months with 5 Mondays, we did group events.
Right, yeah, that's right.
Where all the groups got together. One time we had an arena combat.
That's right, yeah.
Wasn't there a Three Dragon Ante?
I think we did do that, yeah. We had a couple of, like, sort of, like, nights where there were several, like, three-ring circus type of thing going on where you could do different stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it was a good time.
It was, yeah.
So, Chase, how do you convert coming and watching other people play games into this being your job?
Okay, so after I got out of college,
I knew one thing. You majored in something else.
Yeah, I majored in biology, and after graduating, I knew one thing was for sure, and that's that I didn't want to work in a lab or, you know, use my biology degree. So I got a job in a lab using my biology degree. It was cool, you know, like I made a bunch of money and all that, but I was miserable and I didn't like the people that I worked with too much. I particularly didn't like the person that I was working for very much at all. And we butt heads a lot. So I decided that you know, it wasn't for me and that I needed to do a little bit of soul searching and figure out what I wanted to do. So I stopped working there and I went home and I didn't do very much as I was trying to evaluate what I wanted to do. So I was at the store a lot. And
we
then,
also started playing a D&D game around this time as well.
So like my brother and a bunch of my friends had started playing in a group with Derek that I either didn't have time for or didn't have interest in originally, but then after stopping work at the lab, I obviously had more time and developed more of an interest in it. So I ended up doing that with them. And then I think Derek asked us at one point if any of us were interested in, you know, working part-time at all for him, like our group collectively.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent him an email like later that night and the rest is sort of history.
Yeah.
So, I mean, started there, didn't know much about much. And now I run his Plainville store.
Now he knows more than me. Way more.
As any good employee should.
Yeah, yeah, he's completely overqualified.
You know, so you worried he's going to, like, you know, stab you in the back one day and just, like, take over?
I'd probably thank him for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know too much. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
No.
Like, hopefully,
I don't want him the shit he's got to do.
So we can't expect a midnight coup at some point in time?
No.
I mean, just call me out.
It'd be a completely wasted effort.
Yeah. Popcorn law. Yeah. Look at that.
I would just roll over and laugh. I guess.
You can have it. Get out of my face.
Yeah. Now, hopefully one day we own a gaming empire that stretches from here clear around the globe. I think we're just on the verge of doing that.
Well, I mean, something on the order of McDonald's or Subway.
Exactly. Or yeah.
Anything I can do to help. Franchising the wrong guy.
Right now we're studying different languages so we can sort of set up a...
Like Wookiee? Klingon?
Yeah, well, that's sort of a little further down the road.
Yeah.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
We'll take it.
One galaxy at a time.
Hey, we could build the first gaming store on the moon. Come on.
That's true, yeah.
That's ours, for sure.
Yeah.
Right next to the Google Labs?
Yeah.
Google guys are gamers. You know it.
So running stores means you don't have a whole lot of free time. But with the free time you have, what kind of games do you like to play? If any.
I like to play games with girls.
Playing them with them or games that have girls in them? Are they doing inappropriate things?
You know, maybe I shouldn't say anymore. No, well, really, both of us used to play D&D.
Yeah.
but these days there's not much time for that either.
Yeah. Lately an enormous amount of effort has been put into the stores where it's just, you know, when you get your little block of time, it usually involves, you know, something outside of the store, you know, and when we play D&D, it still feels like it's tied to the store. So just lately, you know, you work like 6-7 days in a row and put in lots of hours and you stress a lot about different things and you try to plan for lots of events. And, you know, then you have your little block of time and you kind of don't want to go back to the store to like meet with your friends. And they don't understand. They're like, why are we not playing D&D more? You know, like that kind of thing. But so just lately, that's kind of where it's at. But I would say in a cooler climate, we would probably play more D&D. You know, I love to paint, so I've been doing a little bit of that lately. And I'm interested lately in playing Warhammer Fantasy. So I've sort of just begun working on a Orcs and Goblins army that hopefully I'll be able to finish sometime before 2020. Maybe there'll be a new edition.
Probably not.
I mean, let's see.
Anything like your Necron army?
My 1,500-point Necron army I've been painting since 2002.
Do you know what? I'm a kindred spirit, because I've talked about this a lot on the show, where I still have stuff from third edition 40K, fourth edition fantasy, new in-box, shrink-wrapped, not even assembled, just sitting in my parents, you know, waiting for the day that I open it up. I got a Chaos Warhammer in production since the day that released it. And,
nice.
I understand how that is.
Yeah. But I mean, I think overall, like I started doing this because I love games in general. So I mean, like, you know, I'm always up for a board game when I have time for it.
Apples to
apples is great.
Quelf
is good. Yeah. I mean, just gaming in general. I mean, at this point, like, you love it all, you know, you love it all. I think one fortunate thing, and I think it's something that Chase and I both share, is we'd like to watch games happen maybe as much or more than you do actually participating in them, which is sort of like a weird thing that you find out about yourself after. I'm sure lots of people across the country open up game stores because they love to play games. Not to say that I don't, but as much I like to watch people be happy playing games. You know, like, you know, you sort of like, it's probably just the DM in you, you know, you sort of like to watch, you like to orchestrate it and then watch it happen. Mm-hmm. There's a nice satisfaction that happens there. So that's probably a quality we both have.
Yeah, I certainly like to, you know, have a room full of people playing games. I prefer that over sitting down to play them just about any day. I don't know. These days I'd rather just sort of been on like a, I've had an interest in like building and painting terrain. I don't really ever do it, but I'm interested enough in it. I don't know. Just rather have people playing.
You were working on some painting earlier this week at the painting social.
Yeah. So we recently had a very large 40K event in Plainville. And I stressed a lot about, you know, setting up the tables such that they look nice and are good tournament tables in terms of playability. We walked the room a bunch of times and we're like, okay, what's this table need? What's that table need? How do we feel about this? How do we feel about that? We just kept coming back to, you know, I wish I had one more Imperial Bastion, which is just this little kit that GW makes. It happens to be one of like the three or four terrain pieces that I've built and painted before. So I was like, you know what? Painting social tonight. I'm going to get one of those. I'm going to build it and I'm going to paint it. And I was pretty happy with the way that it came out. I was pretty proud of myself. And I got it done in like half the time it took me to do the first one.
That's fantastic.
Like, got another batch.
So what's next on the table?
Well, I really like the new fantasy terrain that GW has put out, but they're complicated and I don't know how they'd function in terms of like
usability
and how usable they are. Yeah. Like these days I've constantly got, does it look cool? Yes or no. And can I use it on a table for a tournament? Yes or no. And if any one of those answers is not a firm yes, then it immediately gets dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's definitely one of the things that I do take a great deal of pride in. And I think we are probably doing it better than most, maybe better than anybody around. Is our terrain is pretty sick. We've got like a nice collection of really beautiful tables. It makes all the tournaments kind of nice, you know, when you can have, what the most recent tournament we had was 21 tables. 21 tables, which filled the store front to back. And like, it feels like a pretty solid achievement to have 21 tables that are like all fun to play on, you know, like, and look good. They're not just like green felt with like, you know, shoes and bottles on them. They're like, they're really, really nice with quality pieces of terrain. So, and it's our miniatures community is a big, big, big part of what we do. And, we want to give those guys as much as we can. Over the next few months, I want to see, you know, I want to put some effort into making some more really nice, War Machine terrain. Cause oddly, the two games, both being miniature games, they require very different types of terrain to kind of make them, I don't know, usable.
Well, they're two completely different types of games too.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they are. Which is great. That's what you want. You don't want to see the same game rehashed a million times. They play very, very differently. So it's, and the type of terrain that you want to use on the table for both games is also very different. So we want to focus on getting some good quality War Machine pieces, in the next month or two.
I was listening to an episode of, WWPD News from the Front, which is a podcast that talks about Flames of War. It's run by this guy, Stephen McLaughlin, and him and his friends, they podcast together. They're all a bunch of tournament players, and they live down in Virginia. They're trying to, you know, promote playing Flames of War down there. So they went to a store, and the store said, oh, you know, we'll do a thing, and you can come and teach people how to play, whatever. But they ran into a problem with the terrain, because Flames of War, not all, only is it a different era, but it's a different scale. Yeah. So being 15 millimeter, you need something entirely different.
That's right.
So this store, they had tons of terrain, told them, you know, you don't bring anything, but all their terrain was 40K stuff, mm-hmm. which is, I mean, it's great for 40K and you can use it for that, but they didn't have anything for, I mean, hills maybe, I guess, a forest. But Steven was talking about how they didn't have anything for Flames of War, so like they're there with the Flames of War stuff ready to go and do stuff with people, and they didn't have anything for them to play on.
Right.
I mean, they had the table, and like the lack of terrain kind of posed a huge problem for it.
Yep.
So if you're doing some sort of event, you need to be able to create the atmosphere.
Yep, that's true. Luckily, we have the great John Caputo and his wonderful selection of Flames of War terrain.
But
when
amazing.
We do have events, they're nice that he's been supplying us with really good stuff to use. So.
He also supplies a lot of really nice 40K stuff,
he
like
does,
the desert set.
Yep,
that was his, right?
That was actually from Rob Aldred, who's a friend of mine. He had had all that stuff made for a D&D game that he intended to use it for before we even opened up Battleground. And once, unfortunately, his game fell through, he had spent all his money to get these really nice, you know, Egyptian terrain pieces built. That he was like, here, why don't you see if you can use them? So we sort of store them at the store.
They're gorgeous.
Yeah, they are nice.
They don't come out often.
No, they don't. And they're not, they're difficult pieces to play with. Like what Chase was talking about there, they fit the look great category, but some of them are a little bit large for, you know, they're really good for casual type games, but not so good for tournament play. They're just too big.
The last time I remember seeing them was a long time ago. It was the only Starship Troopers tournament I've ever seen play.
Yeah.
When Danger Planet came down.
Yep.
And that was, it was settled on one of the tables on the back towards where people play Magic.
Right.
It was on, you know, you put a big piece of like plywood or whatever on the table, plumped it down, and you saw like arachnids and brain bugs and stuff going at it and all the different Starship Trooper people and stuff all over the place.
Yep.
But that was, I mean, years ago.
It was years ago, yeah, before Danger Planet went away. They were another great store that really did the miniatures pretty well too, so. I can't remember when they went away, but when did they close? Was that like?
I think it was 06, 07.
Maybe. It's been a few years.
Yeah.
That's a guess, but yeah. I feel like it's around there.
Yeah.
We're kind of in an interesting area because a lot of parts, not just of the country, but of the world, they don't have game stores really where people can go and play. And I mean, they have a whole different mindset about it where you're not going to a store to play. You're going to go play with the club, like anybody's place.
Yeah.
Or rent out like the church hall or something like that. But here in New England, we have so many great game stores that cater to different types of games.
Yeah.
And they're all within easy enough access. They're not like right on top of each other because that wouldn't be good. But I mean, they're still accessible for most people, whether, you know, you want to go in Boston or down here on the South Shore with you guys, go up and like Route 9, there's the Wiz, and there's places out in the Western Mass, and then, I mean, New Hampshire, and there's just tons of stores, and it's amazing how they've been able to kind of stand, and mom and pop places is just, as you know, I mean, they don't tend to do well.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're it's been challenging for us too with the you know, stores that when we, you know, selected our second location, you know, you sort of think that everyone's going to be far enough away from each other to not really have an effect, but the Magic community has lots of places to choose from, you know. So you got to try to be the best, you know, and it's tough to do when there's so many places who are doing it, you know.
Well, how do you do it?
Well,
not to give away trade secrets, but
I mean, I think you know, one thing that Battleground has probably always done a pretty good job at is like, you know, taking care of its community, providing a place that is, you know, clean and fun and friendly. It just sort of like attracts the kind of people that are going to help your community grow. You know, so I feel like it's just kind of like one of those things that one follows the other. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if you're providing a fun spot and you know, people are guaranteed to have a fun time when they come down, you're going to get fun people, you know? So, and then they in turn bring more fun people. So, we've always been fortunate. We've got great crowds for pretty much every type of, game that we carry, you know, like it's always room to grow. We want to see a lot more. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty satisfying.
Well, Derek, you keep on mentioning community, which I find important and interesting because a lot of people would refer to it not as a community, but as a store. I think maybe that's one way to identify the success that you guys have had because you work really well and very hard on two things. One, customer service, and two, to make it more than just a location. It's a mindset. It's a cultural state of being.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, you know, one thing that's sort of like in the favor of the person who, you know, is owning a game store or working at a game store is like, if you're there, you probably play games, right? So it's like, you believe in what you're talking about. You know, you're not just selling. You're not selling things to people. You're talking about what you like, you know? So, you know, it isn't like you're trying to make someone buy life insurance or, you know, sell a car that you don't really care about or whatever. You're just, you know, you're giving your honest opinion all the time, you know? And it's even fine. Like, I found myself sometimes like talking to somebody and you're just honest all, you just be honest all the time, you know? Like, I'm not going to tell you if someone comes in and they want a tip on what game they think they should get, you know, it's really easy to direct them to where they need to go. You know, I'm not going to try to get them to buy something that they're not going to like, you know, I mean, there's so much to choose from and it's a fortunate position to be in. You can just be honest. You don't need to sell, you know, I think that's part of the reason why it lends itself to the genuine nature of what's happening. It doesn't feel in your mind, or at least in my mind, it doesn't feel like, you know, these are customers. It feels like these are people that are your friends, you know, like they're a part of what you're doing, which is awesome. You know, like that's something that, you know, you don't get that at the Gap, you know, someone comes in and they just want to buy their shirts and go home. But like, these are people that you see, you know, in some cases, like, take Rob Sims, for example.
Yep.
He was there in 2002 when we opened. It's, you know, 2011 now, and he's been coming since then, consistently, usually for long periods of time, multiple times a week. And, I mean, that's, you know, like teachers who see kids, they get them for a max of 4 years in high school, you know, I mean, it's just, it's kind of cool. You literally watch these guys grow up. It's pretty awesome. That's like another nice little perk of doing this job.
Most of my friends who I have now, I've met as a result of coming to Battleground. And Steve D gets all the credit for that because he's the one who brought me to Battleground the first time. Before my wife and I were married, when we would make plans to do something, and if she didn't know where I was, I said, you know, there are three places you basically need to call. You need to call my cell phone, you need to call my parents' house, or call Battleground, because one of those three places will be able to get in touch with me. And I tried to explain to her that, you know, when I would go with my friends or any of my buddies or whatever, that if we didn't know where we were meeting up, we would always make it a point to stop at Battleground, because chances are at least someone was there, and 9 times out of 10, almost everyone was there.
Yeah.
And so just being able to go, and it's a place to hang out, a place to kind of relax.
Yeah. Steve D is like Google. Like, you don't remember what you did in life without him.
Yeah. Let's talk about Steve D. I feel Steve's a topic in and of himself.
Okay. Yeah, he sure is.
He probably should get a whole separate podcast later. We'll do another one later about Steve, but let's touch on him, definitely.
So I met Steve D back in college through a friend of mine named Ryan. And Ryan was like, oh, I know this kid. And I think you get along with him. He likes to play games. You play with little toy plastic people or something, don't you? And I was like, yeah. And I'm thinking, where's he going with this? Are you going to, you know, start ridiculing me or something? Mm-hmm. And he's like, he plays with little plastic toy dragon people stuff too. So maybe you guys should hang out. So we hung out and, you know, we went down to Battleground. But what are all your stories of meeting Steve D?
Chase has a phenomenal story about how he met Steve D.
Okay. So I spoke about my first encounter with Derek in Battleground earlier, but upon walking in, you know, I had never been there before, and growing up, I used to like to go to little hobby shops or little bookstores to poke around, you know, see the different models, check out the different fantasy and sci-fi books, you know. So I come in, I'm looking around, you know, there's a lot of stuff to look at. Even back then, there was tons of stuff to look at. So I come up to the table that Steve D is playing 40K on with someone who I don't remember. I may know them now, I just, like, they don't stand out to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I sort of peer down, get real close to look at the miniatures because, you know, they're small and they're painted, you know, pretty well and they get tons of details. So I just like, as close as we are now, maybe as close as Drew and I are now, we're sitting at a table.
Just, like a foot apart.
A few feet apart. Yeah.
And he like, immediately, he doesn't know who I am, but he immediately starts he's like, excuse me, you need to back away. You're crowding me. Like, please don't get that close to my stuff. And I was like, what? Like, what are you talking, dude? I'm just looking at your models. Like, yeah, I did bend down. I was probably like a foot away from his space marine or whatever.
You know, trying to
check out what's going on. Like, I don't know what's going on, you know? But yeah, immediately like accosted by Steve, or, like looking at him trying to play his game, like
crowd in his face, man.
Yeah, I guess so. Like,
3 feet distance.
Now I understand.
Yeah,
like I love Steve. Don't get me wrong. Like he is one of the few Battleground legends.
Yeah. Yes.
But man, like right away, like immediately within the first 5 minutes of me walking into Battleground, I'm like getting yelled at by this dude, like looking at his minis. Like I didn't touch him. I'm just looking at him.
But hey. Like, thanks Steve for making our customers feel welcome. Yeah.
Hey, sorry, dude. Hands off, walking away, going to check out something else.
He is amazing.
Derek, what's your favorite Steve story?
Oh boy!
Because I mean, there's lots. We could go for hours.
Yeah,
my favorite involves a hot dog.
Yeah, like some favorites are just not even tellable. But the girl gamer story is always really cool.
That's classic. A good one.
Yeah.
That is classic. Yeah.
So he's hanging out in the store one day, and it's just me and him. It's like early Battleground days, like maybe year two-ish, two and a half. So you know, things are still on the growing stage, and. We had sort of a couple of regulars at the time, who it was a couple. This guy and his girlfriend would come in and they'd play 40K. And one day she came by to pick up something for her army. And I think she was playing because, you know, her boyfriend was into it and she sort of liked what it was all about and got into the painting part of it. She came in to buy some tactical space marines or something like that and was making a purchase at the register. So like I said, it was just me and Steve in the store. So it's quiet, you know, just the three of us in the store and Steve's sitting down painting. And he goes, I can't believe it. There's a girl gamer. I can't believe a girl gamer is in the store. And she's like right there. And she kind of looks at him like, is he messing with me or what? Like, he doesn't really. And I'm trying to ignore, you know, him. So like, you know, I don't want to like make the girl feel uncomfortable. You know, I've talked to her a few times, whatever. I don't want her to feel like weirded out, but Steve would have none of that. He would not have any. He's like immediately like just kept at it. Like, I can't believe there's a girl gamer here. A girl gamer. Wow. He's like just harping on it. So, you know, she, just wants to make her purchase and flee the store as fast as possible at that point. And, you know, which she pretty much does. But even as she's walking out the door, Steve gives one more like, wow, girl gamer, as the door swings shut. And, I don't think I saw her for maybe another 2 or 3 months after that, but she did come back. But,
yeah. Steve. Steve's something else. He's great.
Yep.
Drew, do you have a...
I don't have any Steve D stories. I try and avoid them.
Oh, I mean, there are so many.
There is a rumor that he smashed someone's $750 model out in the parking lot.
Yes, he definitely did.
I mean, he dive-bombed it into the paper.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Spiked it. Like
limited edition Forge World.
That's right.
Thunderhawk, I think it
One
was.
1 trillion pieces in the parking lot.
It was awesome.
It was a mess.
I counted them.
YouTube video I saw.
But seriously, actually, the person deserved it. I mean, Steve should be the only person able to own the Thunderhawk.
They didn't ask permission from what I understood.
Right. I mean, they deserved it.
Speaking of asking permission, someone asked Steve's permission at the latest 40K Mega Battle about bringing a Thunderhawk, and he graciously... gave it. So
dude's the godfather, man. He commands respect. You got to ask him these things, you know.
On the day of his daughter's wedding.
yeah. Make it a masculine Thunderhawk.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Mega Battle.
Yeah.
Mega Battle's been going on for a while.
Yeah, year four this year. Deep sigh from Chase.
What possessed you to start it? Okay, Chase, explain Mega Battle first, because not everyone knows Mega Battle or what it is.
You want me to? Okay. So
what is the Mega Battle?
Basically. I forget which year. It may have been like 2007 or something like that. Games Workshop put out a rule set for large-scale 40K games that they called Apocalypse. And it was designed for games 3,000 points and larger. Now, at the time, Battleground Abington had been around for a considerable period of time, and it had a large 40K following, most of which are people that have been playing the game for a very long time. And... have, you know, built up large collections of miniatures. So we decided that we would, like, Apocalypse was very well received. So we decided that we were gonna, you know, put all of our weight behind this new rule set and design this giant game that would allow, you know, tons of people to field what we thought at the time were tons of models. And just put two different sides against each other. We organized the two sides and the forces of order and the forces of disorder, which is a hotly debated topic in and of itself. But let's just say, like, the worst of the bad guys were on one side versus the not so bad guys on the other.
And you could pretty much guess what's what. You know, Tyranids go to disorder, Chaos go to disorder, yeah. Imperials go to, you know, like Imperial Guard goes to order, and Space Marines order, Eldar order, Tau order, that kind of stuff.
So we basically built this giant table. I think the first year was something like we only had like 25 players or something playing at one time. And each person, I think, got to field 3,000 points the first year, mm-hmm. I think.
That sounds about right.
It's an all-day affair, you know, that involves months and months of preparation beforehand, be it emails or building tables and terrain and dealing with this person crying about that and this person whining about this and, you know, like...
Let's talk about the whining.
You dread the flames.
Oh, you want to hear about the whining.
Let's talk about it, because you're the one who gets all the whining.
Okay.
So Derek gets all the accolades and the, yay, Derek, thanks for doing this.
Pretty, pretty sly, wasn't it?
But Chase, you're the one who, I mean, you've organized your email address so that for all Battleground things, and I would assume most of that's for the Mega Battle. So you have to deal with all the minutiae of all this nonsense.
Yeah, the first year it wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
It wasn't so bad the first year. It was just sort of like, and maybe that's why it was the best. You know, like everyone's sort of doing whatever. You know, no one had, well, few people had really fancy over-the-top stuff. Very few people were trying to find ways to win the game because we were very explicit in saying that this event is not about winning and losing. It's about, you know, the spirit of the game or our idea of the spirit of the game. Year two was a nightmare. And it had a, like year one. After
year two
year
was
one,
mostly day of nightmare though. Like the battle itself was majorly complicated.
Anything
like,
in particular? Or
right?
Well, no. When I say nightmare, I mean like leading up to it.
Okay.
Like so.
How did it differ from year one to make it so bad?
The desire to win increased.
Okay.
So people got a lot more familiar with Apocalypse. Got a lot more familiar with the types of things that you might field when you're playing Apocalypse, which are like the giant titans and super min-max lists that were really good at this or really good at that. And then Games Workshop put out their Apocalypse Reload book sometime, I feel like, after the first Mega Battle. So that introduces tons of other options that are both very powerful and, in some cases, not fair. And it released lots of stratagems that don't hold up when you apply them to a game that has, you know, 20, 30, or 40 people on a board that's, you know, got more square footage than some game stores have, period. So anyways, like year two was when the emails really started to get going, and we had to decide how we were going to rule on this thing and that thing, and then of course, you know, if you go in one direction, someone else gets upset and they email you, and then you've got to do damage control there, and then someone else has another question and it goes back, and it was awful. Year three, however, which is when we decided that we were going to take it up to like what I'd consider a grand scale, we ended up with like, I think it was 40
players, 4,000 points apiece.
That's impressive.
Yeah, 40 players, 4,000 points apiece. We rented a ballroom at a hotel, had like catered lunch, and that was crazy. So at this point, everyone wanted to win. We had players that whether they were serious or not, decided that they were going to, you know, totally win one table and totally blow out other people. And then other people from the other side were like, oh, well, we don't want to play on that table. We don't want to play, period. Yada, yada, yada. You know, oh, that's not fair that they're doing that. It's not cool. This is supposed to be about this. This is supposed to be about that. This person wants to bring these models that they built, but this person doesn't think that those models should be allowed on the table and this and that. So I don't know how many emails I exchanged, but I can tell you for sure I probably spent 40 hours a week for the 3 months leading up to the Mega Battle Year 3 just emailing people back and forth. It was an absolute nightmare.
That's insane.
Yeah, year 4 was not too bad because we had set a lot of the foundation for how we wanted things to go through the nightmare, which was year 3.
It wasn't devoid of drama this year, but it was still like... better.
That's true. It was a lot better this year. My inbox was not hit very hard this year. But there were times year three where I'd wake up and there'd be like 30 emails from people like screaming and crying and whining about this or this person or what this person said on the message boards or what they overheard this person saying about what their team was doing. And yeah, I'm not the biggest fan.
On the other hand, There's something extraordinary that happens on the day of the mega battle that, like, I just feel like we're doing something unusual, in a good way. it's really intensely rewarding to, at the end of the day, to, like, see what's happened. And I think that every year we get closer to achieving, a game that everybody wants to be playing. This year, I think that the only lingering, issues that I'd like to see somehow addressed is the length of time that it takes to complete a turn. So you play from, like, what was this year, 10 in the morning till
9 or?
No, it was about 8.
I think we stopped about 8.
We stopped about 8.
It was a short night.
Yeah, well, it didn't go too long.
Yeah, it's like, you know, so you're playing all day, and, like, I think we got to we finished turn 3.
Yeah.
Right? So that's not a lot considering the amount of time that you play. But there's so many models getting moved around the table. You know, one of the things that I don't know if it's solvable, but we'd like to see turns go faster somehow. It may not be an achievable goal, but, you know, next year, we'll see.
Well, yeah.
This year you solved a lot of the chaos from the launch issue from last year.
Yeah, yeah. And I have a clearer idea in mind what I want to do for next year. We'll announce all those things later, but...
You don't want to announce them yet?
I don't know. I think we probably will not be... going to the hotel again. I want to have a little bit more control on things like the food, the lunch.
That's big news, actually.
Yeah, I feel like having maybe a two break part during the day. Like, one thing I notice is that at lunch, you know, people are very gung ho prior to lunch,
mm-hmm.
and then they come back from lunch and they're feeling kind of charged, and it's a long, slow death at that point where everyone just grinds to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, keeping something that you're looking forward to always helps to keep things moving. So maybe next year we'll do something like a meal around lunchtime that's of a certain size, and then, like, maybe, you know, a second meal or dessert that comes later.
Yeah.
So you've got things to look forward to and kind of keep people there. Because, you can always feel that fatigue set in around 5 p.m.
Yeah.
At every mega battle, where at that point there is a very clear indication that some people just want to wrap it up, you know, like, and this year, one of the problems too was that, a feature of this year's event was that one side was very clearly winning. And when you're, it's always tough for anybody to keep playing a game once you know that winning is, losing is a sure thing. I mean, you're not going to make it, you know, you could wipe your opponent and you're still not going to make it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's people sort of lose their spirit at that point. It's year three was, awesomely close game, and I think that kept people in it. It was really cool.
In year three, despite all the shenanigans leading up to the game, was pretty awesome.
Yeah,
I thought it was fun to be there. Everyone was having fun. It was very close. The things that people were worried about ended up not panning out really. A couple of people introduced some crazy models that no one had ever played against or with before. So that was fun. I guess we're doing it next year. So
you're gonna take a 3-month vacation, right, Chase?
No.
One thing is that, you know, about next year too is, like, one of the big, you know, pains in going into this is, like, trying to create tables for the event. And I was really, really happy with this year's, happier than I've ever been with how the tables came out. I mean, we had 12 4x6 tables all pushed together to make a 48 foot long table,
it was
6
awesome
feet wide, 48 feet long,
amazing.
All connected. It just looked awesome. I had so much satisfaction with it that I think that, you know, next year I would be fine with using those tables again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we'd change a few features here and there, but, right there, just knowing that you're going to go to next year with tables that you're satisfied with takes an enormous amount of pressure off.
Off of
me. Yeah, right. Off of me. Yeah, yeah. That's right.
I'm
recently, Chase and I, or I've voiced something that he's the left brain and I'm the right brain, and together we make one beautiful brain.
We're a good brain.
Well, I mean, one of my favorite things about the Mega Battle is, quite often, it's the scramble at the last minute to get terrain done.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hilarious.
It is. That is fun. Yeah.
I mean, this year, the heat gun broke.
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to shape the mold with
right.
the foam and everything. And I was out front with you when it happened.
Yep.
That was messed up.
It was.
But it's really impressive what I've found the transition from one terrain type to the next.
Yeah, yeah. I was really satisfied with this year. It's maybe someday there'll be a completed video of one of the years other than the first one that demonstrates the awesomeness of the Mega Battle.
Well, you're just sitting on the footage, man.
Yeah, you can go to our Facebook page to see the photos. They are awesome photos. So you can, if anybody's listening to this and you want to check out our Facebook page, there's some really great photographs of every year that we've done the Mega Battle. And you can look at them and clearly see like how it has advanced since, you know, year one. I look back and I just laugh at how those tables looked.
It is funny, you know, like we thought that was something special back then. And now it's like, I remember that night distinctively, like very clearly. It was you and John Caputo, who we mentioned earlier. He's fantastic with terrain and he's built a bunch of our stuff. They got together with a bunch of 4x6 pieces of particle board and paintbrushes and sponges. And they did it all in one night. Yeah. They painted the whole board in one night. And now it's like a 3 to 6 month long process, like making, you know, I guess, what was it? 6 or 8 or whatever custom tables and touching up the others.
Yeah.
Building the terrain for them. And yeah, it's a project. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, why don't we talk about that a little? I mean, Chase, you talked about the kind of administrative side of running an event this large, whether it's Mega Battle or something you can bring to a con or whatever. But Derek, I mean, you tend to focus more on this artist's kind of creative kind of side of creating the world that you're playing in. How do you go about doing that? I mean, you have this time period.
We've sort of refined a little bit like the tools that we use to accomplish it. So like year one, it was like 4x6 particle board with paint on it, you know, which I look at that now and I'm like, just with utter disdain. I would never do that again. You know, like it's just, you know, I mean, it fit that year fine and everyone loved it. And, there are plenty of people that like to just play on flat, featureless boards. You know,
they play town, right?
yeah. You know, the city was very cool year one, I guess. We had like it was sort of an H-shaped table, and the bar of the H was where the city was at. So, you know, that was cool for that year. But year two, we upped the ante, and we started to use, you know, I started to kind of like fashion the tables out of like pink foam, which is just insulation foam that you can get from Home Depot or Lowe's. Maybe someday we'll do like a tutorial on how we do it. You know, I use like a heat knife to kind of carve and cut the foam. And, I think year two is when we first made use of that, I think, right?
Yeah.
Is that when I got it? Yeah.
Sounds right.
You know, it was sort of midway through, I think we started working on the tables and I was cutting it all up with a hobby knife. And I remember the store just being a disaster.
Yeah.
Zone
someone
right
brought in their little Dremel thing and was like using it to sand it to like grind down the pink foam, throwing it all up in the air.
Yeah.
Pink mist in the air. Like,
yeah.
And then, Dave Habermatty brought in like his father's industrial heat gun.
That's right.
And Derek like
melted the tables with it.
It was, he was like, oh my God,
that's awesome.
What have I been missing?
Yeah. And then, I'm sure that at some point I'll wind up in a hospital and they'll be like, why are these pink particles in your lungs? I don't understand. Like,
oh, it'll be all of us. We're all there.
Yeah. So that, you know, year two, the tables got to look a lot better, and, year three more so. And, finally year four, I just feel like we just nailed it exactly what I want. You know, we had a couple of really beautiful ice tables with like, you know, frozen ice water. And it's just that, you know, the three-dimensional nature of the tables really, really, you know, kind of like beefed up over the years. And you just get better at it the more you do it, like anything. You know, anybody who paints or does any of the hobby type stuff, you know that the more you do something, the better you get at it. And that's true with anything. So, you know, hopefully that's true with Chase answering rules questions too.
Well, the thing about it is, one of the headaches is that I don't play the games and I don't know the rules.
Mm-hmm.
So someone emails me, is like, how do you think this works? Well, I mean, I'll look at the rule books and stuff like that, but then I have to consult someone or email someone else to get like their interpretation. And it's never one other person. It's like a committee of people.
And they seldom agree.
And they seldom agree. Exactly. So then you've got to, you know, you've got to choose one of their answers. So some of them aren't happy. Then you've got to give that answer to someone else, and lots of other people aren't happy. It's just like, come on, guys.
And there's one thing that it's, you know, it's for better or worse, probably worse, it has turned into a competition. The annual Mega Battle is very, it has become competitive. And you're dealing with a game who's like, you know, practically, you know, I think in the rule book, it's basically, it defines the game to be played, you know, two buddies who have been playing the game for years and have, you know, 10,000 plus points of models of different armies, and they just want to field everything they can use these rules to play in, you know, mom's basement to kind of like, you know, throw everything they have at one another. Well, you know, the rules, they're not particularly balanced rules. You know, there are some things that are just distinctly better than other things. And, so, you know, it's tough to find to, you know, you feel like you're walking this weird line of, you know, varying opinions and a really crazy array of rules and options that are not in any way, shape or form balanced with one another, and trying to make an event out of it that is becoming competitive. So, you know, I don't know, this year was great. I feel like last year's Mega Battle also was like really, really satisfying day of, despite all of the trouble leading up to it. But, so we'll see what year five has for the Mega Battle. It's a great event. I feel like, we're doing something that nobody else, is really doing, you know. Other places may run Mega Battles, but, I don't know. I feel like we're doing something pretty extraordinary with this event at a level that's probably beyond most, you know. So it's really cool.
One thing I find really incredible with the Mega Battle is the sheer amount of disinformation just flying around the store.
It's forums. It's my favorite part, by far. Just like, we set up exclusive message boards for each team. So the Disorder side will have a private message board that only members of its team can see, and same with Order. And some of us, like Derek, myself, and I gave Drew permission to look at both this year, we get to watch the back and forth, and like, this person will be like, oh my God, the other side's bringing this. Like, we need to be able to deal with this and that and the other thing. And it's not true at all. And the other side's doing the same thing. And like, that is a large redeeming factor for me, especially through all the little, problems that I have to deal with. I get to watch the back and forth and shake my head and laugh at 3 a.m. when I'm responding to people.
Eating your ice cream and Chinese food.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, in talking about the Mega Battle, I think there was some underlying universal game-related issues that kind of popped up. Well, there's a few, actually. One, I think, is this whole gamer versus wargamer aspect on, like, who is the gamer, who's a wargamer, and how do you define them? Like, you mentioned this, how some people were, like, making min-max lists to try to exploit or make the best use out of, you know, what the rules are having to say. And other people take a completely different tack. Like Steve Gee, for example, he's all about the fluff. He likes the feel of it. He's not going to create a list that's going to go and make the best use of everything and, you know, take everything to the exact letter of the rules or whatever to try to get the most advantage he can. He's going to create an army that he likes to play because he likes the story behind it. So how do you feel about how would you describe what a gamer is or a wargamer? Do you think there's a distinction? And how does that come into 40K Games Workshop products in general or other games out there?
That's sort of a tough question. I've never really separated the gamer from wargamer thing in my head before. Just sort of like, each game is designed to be played in a variety of different ways. You've got guys like, you know, Steve D and a large percentage of the player base in Abington, who are playing it maybe as Games Workshop originally intended for it to be played. You know, just people throwing lists together. Maybe they have some coherency. Maybe they're heavily rooted in the fiction or the fluff that they put out for it, that have themes and are representative of something that they've heard about. Playing against people that are doing the same thing to varying degrees. And then you've got people that are treating it as a much more competitive thing, sort of like you've mentioned, that are just bringing lists that are specifically designed to do several things very well. I feel like, well, one of the great things about all these games is that they can be played by different people for different reasons. And like, I mean, just getting back to the Mega Battle, one of the shining star things about it is that Steve D and a super fluffy Ultramarines fourth company list can function just fine. Even though you've got people bringing Emperor Titans and crazy min-maxed other Space Marine lists that have, you know, 3 Terminators with combi melters or whatever designed to kill Titans, you know, for 150 points. You know, it can all play together and it can all have fun together. I've never really been like, oh, well, this person's a gamer and that means this. This person's a war gamer and that means something else. So, I mean, I know it doesn't really answer your question, but I've never really separated the two.
Yeah. I mean, in my head. There are people, like, you can spot the people in any group that, you know, tends to like savor the tactical element of a game more so than maybe like the story or theme or fluff or whatever. Like Chase said, they generally seem to play together fine. Like the guy who likes to play with a themed army that is like very true to the fiction, he's happy to be playing with a themed army that's true to the fiction, even if he's getting, you know, clobbered by somebody who is like building a list that is like
raises his hand.
Yeah. So,
well, I mention this because there's been a lot of discussion in general, but of recent online, both and on the podcast and on blogs and, you know, gaming publications, talking about how GW in general, 40K and Fantasy to a lesser degree, Flames of War and War Machine / Hordes are not war games. They are war games, they're not games. And that people who play them and the intention of the games as created by the game designers and, you know, the companies that support them are to try to create this tournament aspect, and that as a result of tournament play and competitive play, it's kind of been a denigration of the game, where it's forcing people to adhere to being a wargamer mindset, whether or not they want to be. There's nothing wrong with having this wargame mindset and being a tournament type player, you know, a competitive player. But if someone doesn't want to necessarily do that and they want to play these games because their friends are playing in like War Machine or 40K and stuff, you can go anywhere in the world basically and you can get a game of this. Because I mean, it's pretty standard, which is a good thing about it. But if you're someone who just wants to collect what you want to collect, if you want to be able to play with the same level as other people, you need to abandon some of that and participate more in the wargamer feel as opposed to the gamer feel of it. So there's been some discussion on that, and I've just kind of found it interesting. For some reason, this topic has been very important, provocative lately.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very obviously in the internet age for sure. So oftentimes stores like us and others around the world, they'll run tournaments or events in general that have a winner and a loser. And when you've got that dynamic going on, people want to win and they don't want to lose.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to try and tailor their list, be it in War Machine, Flames of War, Fantasy, or 40K, such that they feel that they can win. And then they're going to talk about it on the internet message boards. And then Johnny, the 16-year-old whose parents just bought him an army, can just Google up, you know, hey, what's a great, you know, Tyranid list, or what's a great High Elf list, or what's a great German list that I can bring to this, you know, 1,000-point Flames of War thing or 2,000-point 40K thing. He can put it together and he can show up and he can do well. Well, when the Steve D's of the world, who don't really care about that, show up at that tournament because their local game store is running an event that they want to play in, they bring their Ultramarines 4th Company and get smoked by Johnny the 16-year-old whose parents just bought him Tyranids. It's not that fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, put 10 years behind that, and all of a sudden you've got a situation where the events that happen at any given store, or when someone shows up to a local game store for the first time, they're probably not going to bring the list that they know is going to lose, you know, because they don't know what to expect. So they bring a competitive list. And then the people there are like, oh, well, that kid brought a competitive list, so now I need to field the competitive list or I'm going to get smoked. And then it just escalates, you know. Lots of originality is lost now. And you see it not just in mini games. You see it in just about any game that gets played on a competitive level. Generally, the collective minds of thousands are better at doing any given thing than yours is.
Mm-hmm.
So you can very easily just rip it off and have success. I don't know. It's sort of the way I feel about the whole thing. Like, it might get talked about because a lot of these minis games or the war games did not start with that sort of thing in mind. They started with, like, for instance, if you're playing Flames of War, you're probably bringing a list that is very similar to what you may have seen at whatever battle you're trying to duplicate or something like that. Same thing for Fantasy and 40K.
Really the same thing in Magic too. I mean, sure. Like, yeah, the dude who shows up with like a creative fun deck is like, he's gonna get crushed against somebody who's right. Like, you know, it's anything.
It's kind of sad actually.
Well, I think, like, you know, it's, you just separate it in people should just approach it realistically. If you're going to compete where there's going to be a winner and a loser, and, you know, the winners are getting prizes and the losers are not, you know, if you're bringing a deck that's like built to be fun that you should play with your buddy. You shouldn't be bringing that to a tournament, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, unless you have faith that it's going to win or confidence that you think it's going to win. But then I guess we're talking about a competitive deck at that point.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, there's plenty of time during the week, most days, where you can sit down with your friend and like, or other people at the store, like these, you know, the gamers, the people who prefer, you know, well, using Steve D as an example, but like Steve D can come in any day of the week and he can get a fun game, you know. He's just, if you're going to play in a tournament and you bring a list that isn't tournament worthy or isn't very, very competitive, you shouldn't expect to win probably, you know, and that's okay. I mean, but you know,
yeah, that's one thought. I mean,
yeah, that's anything. I mean,
the community at our stores anyhow is very self-policing, you yeah. know. If you are a newcomer and you bring a certain list and you play any given person, you know, you may win. And then they'll be like, oh, you know, hey, you know, I'm fielding this list. You know, I just play for fun. I like this. I enjoy the hobby aspect. You know, I enjoy playing the game also, but I'm really not in it to, you know, crush my opponent every time. And, you know, people will adjust. I would say that by and large, especially in Abington, you don't see people fielding competitive lists super often. Plainville, a lot of the times they'll do it intentionally. They'll like practice for one of the upcoming events that we have. And then everyone brings their competitive lists or something like that. And sometimes they play team games that are just super casual. But I think that the community overall is self-policing.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a problem in the store.
No, it's not. It's never a problem.
It sounds more like an internet problem. It's more like somebody who's like on a message board, you know, deriding somebody else's list that is not up to what they think is the, you know, paramount version of the game, you mm-hmm. know, and then that person tries to defend themselves, and then a million people come to each person's defense, and before you know it, you know, you've got gamers versus war gamers on, you know, Joe Schmo website, probably, right?
Yeah, I mean, I found myself in the middle of this situation myself. I mean, my orc army loses pretty much every time.
Yeah. Well.
So, I mean, there have been times I've been like, I'm tired of losing. What can I do that's different? I've talked to different guys at the store, gotten different pointers, different tips, and I sit down afterwards, and I look at everything, and I say, it's like, yeah, that would win, but it's not how I want to play.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that first attracted me to coming to Battleground Games and Hobbies was the more casual atmosphere and the limited nature of a competitive atmosphere where it wasn't all about, oh, I need to have, you know, a gazillion, you know, dreadnoughts or some sort of fancy thing. I don't need, like, a tiger tank all the time to come and, you know, do whatever that I could bring whatever I needed to, and that it was accepted and expected. Because, I mean, there are different types of gamers and different types of war gamers and different types of things to play for each person and different types of places to go to. It just so happened to be that places that I had played at beforehand were more in the other sphere, and I am very strictly a gamer. I've always called myself a gamer, and I could care less whether or not I win the game. In fact, I have more fun when I lose, and when I play with someone, I point out how they can beat me.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's some sort of first pleasure or what it is, but, like, it's interesting. Oh, you know, I moved, you know, this unit here, and that means I'm open to a flame charge over here, so you should come around the woods. And then, I mean, maybe that's annoying. I don't know. But, like, and then if you come in, then you're going to cause me to rout, and then maybe I'll fail my leadership, and then you'll overrun me, and you take my unit out, and then there goes, you know, something big and fancy and shiny, whatever. Yeah. So the fact that BG has been more welcoming for that had been a major plus for me. If it was the opposite, I probably would not have come back a second time.
Yeah, I mean, our perspectives are only, you know, we only get them from the experiences that we've had. I do feel like we probably are very lucky with the communities that we've got. You can be any type of player and do just fine. You know, very competitive, very casual, whatever. There's plenty of people there that are up for the kind of game you want to play, which is great. So that's a nice thing.
So you had mentioned with the Apocalypse rulebook how it's intended to be, you know, your players have been collecting for like 5-10 years or whatever. They just have a bunch of stuff in normal games. You're not going to use it because, I mean, you have a bunch of stuff and there's only so much room on the table or whatever. So you and your buddy have like, you know, 5,000 models and you want to put them on the table and play. And it kind of made me think of the Black Powder rulebook by, excuse me, by Worldwood Games, where Priestley and Jervis Johnson wrote it. I'm not sure how familiar you guys are with it, but they wrote it. It's a historical, and I hate to use the term rulebook, it's a historical set of guidelines for how to play games in the Black Powder era. You know, anything from like the French and Indian War and all the way up to the Modest Wars, turn of the century kind of stuff. And their mindset in it, and this is a mindset I feel works really well with me, but I think it's just a really good mindset in general to have, is that, you know, they wanted something to use with their Stealth. Obviously, being in the hobby, they have tons of stuff and lots of space. So in the book, it shows these beautiful pictures of, you know, them with their, like, 5,000 troops on the table and the fact that they can recreate things like Rourke's Drift or, you know, do, like, their own version of a mega battle or whatever between just having them and a couple guys extra per side. But one of the main things in the rulebook that they talk about is that they stress the sportsmanship nature of it, that they use this because they want to have time to get together with their friends, play a game, have some fun, and then still have time left over to go to the pub afterwards and have a brandy or something.
Right.
And that, you know, their guidelines aren't going to be perfect for everything. And that, you know, when you're wrong, like GW always says, you know, roll dice. And, you know, high, low, however you want to do it. And in this, they always, and maybe they overemphasize this, but they talk about just coming to a gentlemanly conclusion. And, you know, what would you do if you were just kind of hanging out with your buddies and you're having, you know, a cola or something? And how could you conclude whatever the situation is to, you know, provide some benefit to people, but for the most reason, to make it more fun? And it's kind of interesting how GW has, you know, kind of something that came before and similar. And, I mean, it's like the other side of the coin. Mm-hmm. But they both kind of coming from the same place saying, you know, we have all this stuff and, you know, you want to get on the table and you want to have some fun with your friends, but that you're able to take something like this and make it even bigger and better, like with the 40K Mega Battle.
Yeah.
And you can just kind of, you can explode it and expand on it and build on it.
Yeah. I'd love to have Games Workshop maybe take, I don't know. It's like one of those things I think they would be interested in, you know, like to see one of these mega battles. Like, I don't know. Maybe someday in the future we'll get them to take a larger interest in what we're doing. We'll see. It's something I think it would probably be a nice article in White Dwarf, you know, like, I don't know, a battle report of what happened during the mega battle. It would probably be a really cool article. But we'll see. Maybe someday we'll get them to come down and look at what we're doing.
Send an invite next year.
Am I going to write it up? No. I think White Dwarf or Games Workshop has people that could write it up for me. But I don't know. I don't think that that's too far out. Got a pretty good relationship with the GW rep, and I have reason to believe that I'm going to be talking to, you know, other Games Workshop departments sometime in the foreseeable future. So hopefully we can get them to come down one of these days and check it out. But hey, we'll see. I'm gonna not worry about anything that has to do with the Mega Battle until sometime in 2012.
Yeah.
So
Drew, you haven't played in the Mega Battle at all, but you have your Orc army in the works. Are you intending to make an appearance, or what's going on with that?
At some point in time, I'd like to make an appearance.
Like, you know, by the time before you're dead, or?
Well, yeah, it's just crazy financial responsibilities. Uh-huh. You know, 40K is not a cheap game.
No.
Getting 4,000 points is not a cheap endeavor.
That's true.
I would like to play it. Honestly, I'd like to see if I could field 4,000 points of Ludas, which is...
Oh, Jesus.
It's 250 models.
It's a lot. It's a lot
and
of models.
At 5 models per box and a little over $30 per box. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's... I have 20.
I won't stop you.
I know you won't. You won't stop me to do a lot of things.
You can place a special order right now. We can take a break if you need to fill out the paperwork.
That's right.
Or
I'm sure.
Assign my life and all future earnings
over.
I'm
not sure how many boxes of loot they have at the warehouse. Yeah. But we may be able to get them for you, Drew.
I don't think GW would mind me placing that order either.
Yeah. No, probably not. Yeah. One of the things I love about the Mega Battle are the awards that you guys have come up with.
Yeah, it's a fun part of the day, definitely.
So why don't you talk about them, like what the awards are, how you kind of came up with them? And
well, you know, the whole idea of the Mega Battle at its core is that it's something that we want the community that plays and loves the game and has bought into it to outrageous degrees to be able to, you know, field everything and have a really, really fun day. And, you know, because of that, we didn't want to have like, you know, have it be like the winning side gets prizes of whatever. Instead, we wanted to have it be more merit-based, you know, like try to do cool things, try to do fun stuff, you know, try to make the day more fun for other people. And all the awards that we give are, you know, kind of like geared towards that kind of fun in mind, you know, like, the person who lost the most points, for example, in a flyer. I think it was like Talk to Me Goose Award.
Yeah.
It's a really miserable Top Gun reference. But I think Sean McDonald won that with his downed Thunderhawk that contained 2,000 points.
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff is where we aim to fall. And, you know, there's some serious awards, but, you know, we try to be funny and light and just make the day as fun as possible.
Well, there's always the iconic BG award of the Steve D award.
The Steve D yeah. award, yes, which was a surprise upset this year. It ended up going
to Cookie.
Yeah. It was the second year I think we introduced the Steve D award. First year, of course, it went to Steve D. This year, sort of like Cookie came by and just swept it out from underneath him. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, we had a little checkbox on a survey that we passed out to everyone. It says, "Are you Steve D? Yes, yes or no?" We were going to use that to determine who won the Steve D award. Obviously intended to go to Steve D. But Cookie, he checked off that he was Steve D despite the rivalry between the two. I can't remember if Steve checked off the box or not.
He did. He checked it. Okay. He was Steve D. Yes. Yeah. But he had won it the previous year.
The votes came in and, Cookie took it home.
We don't want to reveal too much. This is very, very similar to how popes are elected. We don't share how we come to these incredibly important decisions. Suffice to say that it is a very mathematical process that determines who is the Steve D winner every year.
Yeah. So,
do you guys have a favorite award that you have out?
That might be my favorite. There were some that were pretty funny this year. What were some of the other ones?
Any awards that maybe you haven't done yet that you want to do or that you've done that you wish you hadn't done?
Every year I always appeal to the community for like some ideas on things that would be good. We got some good ideas this year.
Yeah, there were a lot of good ideas, but for some reason a lot of them are slipping my mind right now.
Yeah. It's tough too, like because it's an incredibly chaotic event. I mean, it's like the very definition of controlled chaos. And so coming to, like, for example, one of them was, like, I think first kill, right?
Yeah.
It was a first kill. But, like, there are 40 people there this year with, like, 4,000 points apiece all playing simultaneously on a 48-foot-long table. So how do you really determine the first kill? I mean, like, you know, so we had someone try to, you know, like, shout out when your first guy gets removed from the table, the first actual. And I think Chris Brett ended up getting it, I think.
Oh, right? Yeah. He won a lot of awards, I think.
He also got, like, best last stand.
Yeah, heroic last stand,
which is cool.
He made a clean sweep of the awards.
Yeah, he did. He did pretty well. That's, like, I just liked a lot how he played this year. I mean, he was, like, facing down insurmountable odds and just took it all with a great big smile and like savored all of his long, slow death. It was great. That's how you should play the game.
Well, that's what it's for, you know? It's Chris Brett plays it the way I think it was always meant to be played.
Yeah, it was good. He did a good job.
So why don't we talk about the hobby side of gaming for a while? I mean, we kind of talked a little bit about terrain making and that sort of stuff, but let's talk about painting. Now, we all paint now. To some degree of level. I think most of us are probably, well, I consider myself a newbie to painting, and I think
I certainly am.
Some of us.
I've been painting a long time, anybody who's painted for long periods of time can probably know that they've had like sudden leaps in improvement. You sort of, when you're a kid, you know, like 10 years old and you're trying to paint and, you know, you're doing things in a very basic kind of way and you haven't really picked up any of the skills that are necessary to kind of like climb to the next level. And then at a certain point, you learn those skills and you make a nice big jump and then you paint that way for a long time. And then you learn a few more skills. And, the longer you do it, the better you get. Being around other people who are incredibly talented, like I've had the fortune of being around at Battleground, you learn a lot. We have, Sue Ruggiero, who's one of the regular painters at the store, who's
she's amazing,
really amazing painter, and she's had a lot of her work appear in periodicals and things like that. She's just very, very, very talented and a good teacher too. Like just painting with those people in the nearby vicinity just helps you improve. So,
well, we've got Paul Calder. He today at the store in the
quarter. Yep, and that was a mutual project between him and Sue. I think he had a lot of the ideas for the model, and she sort of constructed and painted.
Yeah, she built and painted it. Yeah,
and it just got the honorable mention.
It did. Yeah. So that was cool.
So that's congratulations to Paul and Sue.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Nice to see that sort of stuff.
Yep.
But I remember spending a lot of Tuesday nights sitting next to Sue working on my army.
Yep. She's done a couple of little classes for us at the store too. Probably get her to do those again.
Yeah,
they were very helpful.
Nice.
She's really talented.
Now, big difference I've noticed between Abington and Plainville is an expectation for painted armies. Abington, it's taken for granted. You're pretty much always going to play against a painted army. I don't see that many at Plainville.
There's probably some reasons for that. I think we've got a lot of new players, so that...
Yeah, there's a lot of new players down there.
This is something that I think as you go to different stores, you'll find different schools of thought, but always it has been, my contention that, like, people who are getting into the game, you don't want to tell them they can't play, you know? Oh, yeah. There's two parts to it, you know? Like, there are people who take great pride in their painting and they don't so much care about anything else. And then there are some people that just want to play competitive lists and they don't care much about the painting. You just want to see people playing, you know? So we always encourage people to start playing as soon as their models are assembled, you know? Mm-hmm. So in Plainville, we've got a lot of new players. So there's a lot of new armies that are, you know, just beginning. So we get them playing as soon as possible, you know? So.
Chase, do you have any painting lessons you've learned along the way or things you've done that you wish you hadn't maybe? Or?
Painting lessons? Sure. Dry brushing is fantastic.
Yes, it is.
That is about the only thing that I sort of know how to do.
Okay.
I can take my big tank brush and I can put on a foundation paint. Usually it's gray. And then I can take some lighter color gray or anywhere between gray and white and dry brush like a champ. And sometimes it comes out cool and sometimes not. You know, but no, it's really the only sort of technique or thing that I have any real experience with or know how to do. And fortunately, sometimes it comes out okay. So I'm all right with it.
I think we all kind of use the GW, GW method of painting. Where, you know, you do some sort of base coat, you do, you know, some sort of dry brush, do an ink somewhere in there.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, the Foundry Kevin Dallimore method where, you know, you're outlining in black what you're doing, you're doing your three or four different, you know, layers of painting. And I think one of the great things about the GW method is that it makes it easier, I'm not going to say easy, but easier and a little quicker for people to get stuff painted so that it looks... So like a gaming standard, so it looks halfway decent on the table when you're like 3 or 4 feet away.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, the GW standard is very quick, especially if you're playing a Horde army.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the Necron ever going to get finished?
I don't know. Maybe we'll see. We'll see when they get a new codex, maybe I'll return to them. But
yeah.
Which probably is coming up in the not too distant future.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it is.
Oh, I can't say that. Never mind.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, yeah. I sent an email to GW a long time ago. I sent an email to GW a long time ago asking for when the next Orc Codex was going to be released. They said 6 months.
They lie.
4 years later.
Yeah.
Which is about what I expect from GW on timelines.
Right. Yeah, they've actually been a very good company to work with over the past couple of years. Great. We get just very good customer service through them, and I've been nothing but good reports.
Yeah. It's my favorite phone call of the week. Chris Kaler at GW. He's our rep. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
Love talking to him. He does a great job. He's very helpful.
Get a lot of support.
So I'm just kind of flipping through. I have tons of topics, and we've covered quite a few.
Okay.
Well, actually, I have a question I'd like to ask you guys. Now, as an owner and manager of game stores, how do you guys feel about the recent trend in the game publishing industry of making ebooks almost exclusively in some areas like White Wolf?
Yeah.
They're switching to all ebooks.
It's a concern. You just got to keep an eye on it. And, like any business, you're going to have to adjust with technologies and things that change and changing opinions and what's popular and what's not. It's one of the things that you have to deal with. You have no choice. Personally, I have always been someone that likes books. You think that because of that, there must be other people out there just like you. Take Pathfinder, for example. Those are books that, like, I own the actual books, but it's also nice to have the PDFs. I think I think a lot of gamers feel that way, you know, like, it's nice to have both. I mean, then again, there are more and more laptops at gaming tables than there have ever been before. You know, people tend to use their iPads a lot and things like that. So it's changing. So we're just going to have to keep an eye on it. I imagine that, somewhere down the road, we'll be seeing 5th edition Dungeons and Dragons coming out at some point. Very curious to see what kind of changes, if any, they enact. We'll see. It's definitely something that, you know, I wouldn't want to see the entire role playing game market go to ebooks.
Yeah.
Obviously, I mean that would be bad for I imagine it would be bad for everybody. I don't think it would even be good for the game companies. It won't surprise me to see White Wolf at some point maybe go back to producing some books again. But who knows?
I think it's kind of interesting that they would switch completely over to that. I've talked on the show recently quite a bit about my love for a digital format of stuff, but it doesn't always work. I've ran into some problems lately which were not the fault of the publishers or the actual file, more fault of the device I was using. But with War Games Soldiers and Strategies, I have a digital subscription to it, and part of the reason why I subscribe is because they have a digital sub. Otherwise, I wouldn't. I mean, they're based in the Netherlands, and I mean, there's a lot of issues. So I've long said, you know, I love digital subs for periodicals, and I want, you know, rules to come out digitally, but not by themselves. Like with this particular magazine, I had some trouble accessing it on my device. I was using a first-gen iPad, and it just happens to be my particular iPad had issues. But it was basically unusable for me, and I mean, I was very discouraged. And thankfully, yes, for Orthler, the big boss over there, spent quite a bit of time via email with me trying to get it to be where I would be happy with it. But like, if you only have like a rule book, whether it's for 40K or it's for Magic or you know D&D or whatever, and it's only digital, that poses some problems. Not everyone has the devices for it, and the choice to make it exclusive for one format or the other, I think it can't be an easy choice, but it has to. It doesn't seem like it's a wise choice either.
Yeah, yeah. I think everybody's got their eye on it. I think the publishers are, you know, they're trying to figure out where things need to be, and consumers are trying to figure out where they want things to be. It's complicated. It's the same thing the music industry is going through, similar stuff, you know, like, we'll see. Who can predict it? I mean, I guess, you know, people will vote what they want with their dollars, I guess. But let's keep your eye on the trailblazing companies like Wizards of the Coast and Games Workshop and those kinds of guys. I mean, Games Workshop is in their game is going to remain tactile. I mean, that's for sure.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
They've got their digital market and their video games that are based on their game, but they're a miniatures company. That's not going anywhere. You know,
I don't see their books switching to ebooks.
I don't think painting a model in Photoshop is quite as satisfying in real life.
I don't know. I've had a few of things yeah. that I wish I could have taken back.
Well, one kind of weird thing with gaming related stuff in a digital format is if you're trying to make like an ebook, so to speak, of it, the number one e-read is a laptop, just a generic laptop. But the Kindle is high up there and a lot of e-ink devices are up there. They're not in color. So you lose any benefit you get from that. And a lot of gaming related stuff, that color adds a whole lot to it. And I mean, yeah, they could do it as a PDF, so you could read it as that for a lot of devices. But again, none of the e-ink devices you'd be able to use like on a, you know, a Nook Color or an iPad,
right.
A laptop, of course, or a computer or whatever, or I mean, your smartphone even. But like, you're losing a huge market share unless you find some way to make the change.
Well, I remember being concerned when Magic Online was starting to get like really big. And I was sort of worried about like, how is that going to affect the game? But they're two very distinct markets that like one, I mean, if anything, it probably seems to have like, you know, made the game more popular.
Yeah, it certainly made the game a lot more popular. Not necessarily on the local level. As a matter of fact, on the local level, I feel like it may hurt the turnout to local events, but certainly on a national level, it's really increased the game popularity and turnouts at larger events. You've got these Magic Online celebrities that go and perform very well on pro tours or at bigger events. You know, you hear like, oh, where'd they come from? It's like always Magic Online these days. Magic Online has been great for the game. There's no doubt about that. If it weren't an option, I feel like fewer people would play. And I guess, I don't know, maybe turnouts would be a little bit better, but maybe not at, you know, a Friday Night Magic or something. I think people can find the game a lot easier because there's an online option, which they advertise on their website, and like there's a free little, you can play Magic Online for free and everything. So, no, it's good. I like that it's there.
We'll see how it... D&D might, you know, there's some rumors that D&D might like lead towards that kind of a thing. I think it would be, I'm not so convinced of that, but like there's a lot of like online chatter right now about how D&D 5th edition might go to a, you know, entirely online format. I personally think that would be a giant mistake for the game to make. I actually don't think that that's going to happen personally, but we'll see. There's no way to tell.
The only benefit I see to it is something like, I have a friend who lives in Oregon. If we wanted to play a game together, something like that would be good for us.
Right.
But, you know.
But then you play WoW.
Nothing really, no, I don't. Well, nothing will really beat getting around a table like we're at right now, breaking out the dice and the character sheets and just hanging out.
Yeah. I mean, and it would show like a very, I don't know, a disconnect, I guess, from the people who are making the game to the final channels where it's being, you know, played and produced and promoted. Like, what does it mean for the game store when, you know, D&D books are no longer available for you to sell on your shelf? Like, if you are only getting PDFs through Wizards of the Coast by a subscription, where's the incentive for a game store to get behind that kind of a game? So you're, and Wizards of the Coast has such a strong relationship with their retailers. I feel like that move it would be very strange, but we'll see. I suspect that in another year or so, we'll probably see where it's going.
So we haven't talked about D&D at all. And D&D is really a show in and of itself. But do you guys want to talk about it a little bit? Because you're both big D&D people. I think
sure.
We've all played D&D at some point.
Oh. Yeah, it's what brought me to the hobby and kept me here, you know, for 30 years. It's a big part of like what I was interested in, like growing up as a kid, and like I mean for better or worse, it's a big part of like who I am and what I read and you know what I consume, all that kind of stuff. I've played through pretty much every edition of the game. I think the only one that I did not actually play was the you know very very first D&D pamphlets. You know, like the back in 1972 when they released like, you know, D&D, the, you know, 32 page pamphlet and, it's several follow up books, Greyhawk and Eldritch Wizardry and all these other books. I never actually played with those versions. I own them and read them out of just pure nostalgic joy, but I never played them. But I did, you know, I played basic edition D&D, first edition D&D, which is, you know, I think they call it OD&D too, which I think is like maybe referring to the original pamphlets or whatever, but. Upgraded to second edition, upgraded to player's option when that was out in the mid 90s, upgraded to third edition, upgraded to 3.5, tried fourth edition, didn't fall in love with it. So I tend to kind of like hang around with Pathfinder at this point. But everybody has their tastes and, you know, the game, there's a version of the game for everybody, but I still kind of hold out hope that the best edition of D&D has not been made yet. You know, it's changed a lot. It's evolved a lot. Maybe the consumer is different today than the consumer that I was, you know, when I was growing up. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. I mean, Pathfinder is definitely filling the niche for the people who are big fans of 3.5 and I don't know. It's the role playing game market is going through a lot right now. You know, the MMORPGs have had a huge effect on what makes for a good game and what people have come to expect. And I think, you know, it's just different appeals. I don't know. I'm not sure what a kid today getting into the game would really prefer. I think Chase thinks that like fourth edition tends to appeal to like the more.
Yeah, I think so. Fourth edition, lots of people like to tell you what's bad about it. But what's good about it is that it's simple. It's quick. It can be fun. It's very easy to learn. You don't need to slog through tons of books. You know, you don't need to scratch your head and be like, what? You know, like it all sort of just makes sense. It's high intensity. It's high action. You know, that's what people want these days. You know, there's lots to be said about, you know, the D&D of 10 or 20 years ago, which is primarily based on, you know, the storytelling elements. But I mean, for better or for worse, people want action now, you know, and like the markets have certainly changed. I think Derek's the exception to the rule. Like, so a player who's been playing for 30 years, almost 40, you know, got a wife and a kid and he owns a small business. Like, those types of people probably don't have time in their lives for D&D anymore. Mm-hmm. But the 15-year-old kid does and the college kid does and they're different than us. You know, they want different things. They expect different things and they know different things. So it's not to say that they don't want or appreciate some of that other stuff, but it's certainly not. I mean, this is the generation that grew up with Halo.
Yeah.
You know, this is not the generation that grew up like reading books, you know? So, I mean, that's what we're dealing with. And
I had combat on Atari 2600.
I grew up with an Atari. I don't know what the hell you guys.
So I feel like Wizards of the Coast is doing what they feel is best based on where they want the game to be going. You know, you're seeing all this shift towards a more digital, a digital game. And I think that whereas that would be bad for a store like us, I think it's a good move for them.
I disagree. I don't think, I'm not so sure that, Wizards has the, I mean, look at what happened with the release of fourth edition where they were, heralding all these like unbelievable changes. They were going to do like the online game table and, you know, Wizards of the Coast is not Blizzard. I'm not sure that they have the talent, you know, to kind of, to put out that kind of a thing. And their talents lie in other regions, I think, you know. I don't know. It's the argument over what makes for a good role-playing game. We literally could just go on and on about it, you know, like it's people hold their opinions pretty intensely on it. Like I've run really successful games and I've played in and run games that were not so successful. And, you know, you look back at them and you can see the reasons why certain things were successful and why certain things weren't. You know, the game, role-playing games seem to thrive when there's like a sense of mystery in the game. And, you can see some of that stuff begin to disappear over the years when the editions were released. So for example, the first edition Dungeon Master's Guide practically told you on page one or two that if you were a player and you were reading the Dungeon Master's Guide, you were effectively cheating. You know, like this is the realm for the DM and like he's got surprises planned for you and like it's better if you don't know what's in this book. And, you know, I get the arguments like, some groups have multiple DMs and they don't want to DM all the time, in which case, what are you supposed to do then? You know, you've got to have players who are reading the DMG. But, you know, just the idea of like what's in there. There are secrets in that book and like the DM's going to like reveal them in good time or through good player play, you know? But over the years, you know, it's better for the company to sell three books to everybody than it is to sell like, you know, just the Player's Handbook to everybody. So, you know, the mentalities changes and over the years you've seen some evolution and now you open up the fourth edition Player's Handbook and like every magic item in the game is in the Player's Handbook, you know, whereas before that was like, you know, unlocking secrets, you know, like that's what you would learn. But, that sort of speaks to a lot to what Chase is talking about, where this generation might be, I don't know. These are just sort of things we're saying, but who knows? Like they might want more now, you know, like they want to know what they can get. Like, is that truly like a character trait that's existent in today that wasn't in existence when I was a kid? You know, like, I don't know. It's weird. You think we'd know this by now, but watching all these games get played at the game store, but.
Well, I've been playing D&D the shortest out of everyone here. Because, I mean, I've been playing a Teddy Roosevelt's game. And, well, not anymore, but, I mean, that's my whole D&D experience. But coming into it, I was really glad that 4th Ed did come out because I had looked at, you know, some 3rd edition and 3.5 books beforehand. And they were just so dense. And the realization that how much time it would take to get into it was so off-putting to me. Because if a game isn't easily accessible, I don't care how good it is. It could be the best game ever made and everyone else is playing it, but if it's not easily accessible, I'm not going to want to get into it.
I think that's right on. Like, I think that the vast majority of people these days in this world identify with that an incredible amount. There's just not enough time. There's just not enough.
And there's so much out there too that it's no longer the case of where the gamers have to then come to the game. So the game has to market themselves to the gamers and say, you know, I'm a game on the shelf and there's 15 other games just like me on the shelf. Well, why do you need to come to me? And whether it's, you know, some sort of display purposes or the rule mechanics or whatever, but it needs to do something to make itself attractive to the gamer and say, I'm the one you should be spending your $30 on to buy the game. And you need to come in and choose me. My former co-host, Tom Barbalay, months ago, we were talking about this and he wrote this book, Guild of Chaos, and he's writing RPG rules for it. And Derek, like you, he's strictly from you should have all the stuff in the setting and the intricacies and everything with it. And he was dismayed when I told him how I thought 4E had something really good going for it and that I thought people crave this, the fact that it's accessible, that it's simplified, it's a little easier to kind of get into and that you can just stop in, you can pick up some dice and you can roll them and do that and then you can walk away and it's okay. And, I mean, he was in the middle of writing his role-playing rules. And, I mean, they can be coming out sometime soon, but then not this. And so he was concerned about the marketability of it. And, I I mean, you still publish, and yeah. that's other issues entirely.
You're marketing. You're definitely marketing to two different people, and you definitely have two different games. Just like, you know, a movie like Transformers that's complete garbage.
I knew you were going to bring that.
Does incredibly well. I mean, it's, you know,
that's just
terrible movies. Like Transformers 2 is an awful movie.
Let's
terrible from top to bottom. Bad writing, everything. I mean, and the argument you'll hear is like, I just want to go and watch giant robots smash into each other. Like,
that's right.
That's yeah. it's exactly what we're talking about, though. Yeah. Like that movie makes more money than, say, like, I don't know. I'm not going to even like date myself by picking like a very
Clerks.
An in-depth character movie. Like, I'd go even more than that. Like something that's got like you know, a lot of depth and a lot of intricacies to it. Like a complicated plot, things that you have to follow carefully. Like. You know, those movies don't make as much money as big, smashy robot movies or, like,
well,
terrible
actually
action movies.
Well, less to, you know, make, too.
So. But it's what we're talking about, right? I mean, like, they're, like, one, you know, there are people who are going to be drawn to either of those two things. Like, a movie that I might think is really great because of its, like, intricate plot and complicated plot or, like, you know, great character. Somebody else might be like, oh, that's boring. I don't want to listen to people talk for 2 hours. I want to watch, like, stuff blow up and smash, you know, like... That's sort of like what we were talking about, like a very simple, easy accessible game that anybody can sit down and play, you know.
Do you think part of that's a sign of the times, though, with, I mean, we have they're not calling it a recession, but we have a recession going on. I mean, there's all the wars we got where in Afghanistan, where in Iraq, the terrorist troubles, like everywhere in the world, the fact that, you know, everyone's currency is tanking, and there's all these problems. And, I mean, it feels like more now than they have been that people – have enough of that in depth that they have to focus and spend the time thinking about in their everyday lives. And so that, I mean, games, part of the definition I feel of game, besides the fact that it should be, you know, fun, is that it takes you away from the other stuff, and that maybe people just don't, they're so worn out from all the energy expenditure of dealing with everything else that they don't have that
it might be.
Reserve we're, to put forward right
we're,
now.
We're sort of working on fixing that, though. We talked earlier about game stores we're going to do across the world. We
yes.
have one coming out. We're going to put one in Iraq pretty soon in Afghanistan. yeah, like I'm having some trouble learning Arabic right now, but I'm getting there. Close.
I got it covered.
You got
cool.
Yeah.
Dude, thanks. left brain.
Yeah. Right to left.
Yeah. Yeah.
My cousin does speak Arabic if you need him.
All right, good.
Yeah. I'll throw him on.
We're going to need employees.
We'll solve it.
So I heard a rumor that I don't know when, but that there might be a third store opening.
Well, it's always an option. I mean, we're gonna, you know, probably always be looking at that kind of stuff in the future. And you know, there are no decisions made that you know I'm gonna share right now. But you know, we're always looking for ways to expand and grow and bring what we're doing to new communities, and I think that we've got a good model, and I think there's a lot we can do with it, and we're going to keep going. You know, everything's going well, and we're happy with where we're at. And
where would you put a third store?
It would take a lot of research to answer that question.
It's like,
well, you don't have to. Of course, I'd love you to say, oh, we're going to build one,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
Walpole or you know. Provincetown or something.
It won't be in Walpole.
Oh,
how about that?
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with Walpole. It's
no,
just
like
smack dab in between.
But yeah, like, yeah. What is the ideal location for a third store? Like, what attributes does it have? Characteristics? What would lure you there?
Tropical.
A government not like Plainville would be a must.
I would probably guess you'd probably want somewhere either Metro West or North Shore.
Are we talking like near Worcester kind of stuff, or are we talking up near like Danvers, Reading area?
I mean, I'm not trying to be evasive. It's just it's too complicated a question to answer. I mean, it depends on lots of stuff. It depends on like where the retail market is at the time that we decide to move on something like that. It's complicated.
Yeah, maybe most importantly, it's like where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
When
yeah.
it's time,
right?
You know, that was a large factor.
Oh, yeah.
Involved in choosing where we were going to open store two. We looked at a lot of places, and we were both like, "Well, we don't want to drive an hour."
Yeah,
to and from work.
Besides him, who does?
I really appreciate you opened it up at the street from my friend's house, though.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
that was the final decision. Actually,
yeah. So we're like, Drew's friend lives right at the street.
Do it.
We're pulling the trigger.
Yeah.
Second thing on the checklist.
Yeah.
So New Hampshire next.
Well,
I got a friend up there. I mean,
that's a long ride. That's a bit of a commute.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a commute.
Yeah. Now, people tell us all the time, they're like, oh, you've got to come to this spot or that spot. I heard like a couple weeks ago, you know, you've got to come to Connecticut. You know, there's nothing in this area in Connecticut. And it's like, you know, it's tough. Like picking a spot is tough. I mean, like before we opened Plainville, I was on Derek to open a second store for years.
Mm-hmm.
And like,
thank you, Chase.
Things take a long time here at Battleground.
Yeah.
To go from,
well, I mean, we're still waiting for the 40K Mega Battle video.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, things take a long time. You know, like idea to finished product is, it can be a very, very long process.
And the end of that long process usually ends up being a scramble.
Yeah.
Absolute.
That's a fact. Yeah.
That's how
Derek likes to do things. Yeah. He's got the idea.
We operate best under pressure, right?
Yep.
Now, are there any big plans coming up for the next year besides, you know, the Mega Battle? Maybe with the new Storm of Magic release for Fantasy, Warhammer Fantasy, you're going to try and do a approximate equivalent for Fantasy?
Well, there's a new website coming too, I believe.
Yes, there is.
Full plate.
Yeah.
As Chase Renz is here.
It's a full plate. This year has got a lot of potentially large projects.
Yep.
That I am both excited about, and I really, honestly, it's getting to the point where I don't know how it's all going to fit into my life. I don't know. I feel like right now, life is pretty saturated.
Chase, it doesn't fit into your life. Your life fits into this.
Yeah, well, that's probably true. But no, there's a couple big things. Obviously, the Penny Arcade Exposition decided to come out to the East Coast a couple years ago, and last year, we threw that together last minute in Drew Battleground fashion, and it worked out pretty well for us.
Yeah,
so obviously we have that. There's obviously the Mega Battle.
Will you guys be going to more cons? Because, I mean, there's tons of cons in the area. Total Con, there's Havoc up in New Maine, there's Huzzah. I mean, there's tons of stuff.
I don't foresee us going to all of them or even a large percentage of them, but I can say for sure that we'll probably have a larger presence at TotalCon.
Mm-hmm.
It's like literally right up the street from the Plainville location. I don't know if we're going to do too much else with other conventions other than maybe run some more events or just have more of a presence at TotalCon in an effort to spread what we do to the community in the area.
Yeah.
We will probably go to the Unity Games little production that they do. Unity Games is a large collection of board gamers in the Massachusetts and greater Massachusetts area. They put on a thing every winter that attracts about 400 board gamers.
That's impressive.
We, unfortunately, this year, it happened sort of soon after we opened Plainville, and I thought it was happening on the weekend after it did happen on, so I sort of missed the boat on that. We're in like the pre-planning phases of maybe like a larger minis gaming, you know,
like a gaming day?
Thing, sort of like maybe something like that, like a larger tournament, like a weekend long tournament type thing that may or may not pan out. That's going to be an extraordinary amount of work that I am a little intimidated by, but we seem to pull it off pretty well when we try to attack these bigger things, and. Who knows what else is going to come up?
Do you think we'll see another showing at PAX East when they come through next year with Anime Boston at the same time?
We are definitely going to do PAX East again.
Yeah.
In a perfect world, we will do it right, for real, this time. I think things went really well last year for us in about every respect that we could have possibly hoped for. I think if we left anything on the table last year, it was probably the taking advantage of the opportunity to let a large amount of people in the area know exactly who we are, what we do, and most importantly, where we are.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen some people come through Plainville that found us at or through PAX this year, but not the number of people that I would have liked. And granted, the Plainville store is a little further away from Boston than Abington, but I feel like we fell short of maybe where I would have liked to have been this past year. But hopefully we can get a nice little army together this year and really do PAX really well. I think the staff in the tabletop hall really liked us last year.
Yeah, we had a fantastic staff, and like all the guys who came and helped us out this year were just like phenomenal. Like everybody, just very, very professional, very, very helpful, and like, taught a lot of people how to play a lot of games. So it was great. We had like a lot of fantastic help. And I think they had a great time, and they all seem like they want to come back. Plus, we've got lots more that want to join on this year too. So we should have a really, really great show this year at PAX, I think.
That's good.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. It's a lot of work in a short amount of time, but it was a lot of fun, and I think it was definitely worth it. I would definitely do it again in the same way, in a heartbeat. Great experience overall, and I really want to do it the right way this year if we didn't do it the right way last year.
We just sort of decided very, very late that Chase and I have this very typical conversation that comes up every time we talk about doing a new thing, and it goes something like this. I'll be like, Chase will be like, hey, we should probably think about doing X, whatever X might be. We should probably think about doing it. And he'll say something like that and whatever it is, and then I'll get sort of excited about it. I'll be like, yeah, I think you're probably right. We probably should do it. And then he'll go, okay, but this is what it's going to mean. And it completely talks me out of it. That's exactly what happened with
PAX. The realist. All I really want to hear is, and fortunately I get to take this position, which I like, I think. All I need to hear is, yes, let's do it, or no, we're not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times I don't have a strong preference which answer I get. I just want to have one. And then we'll go. And then it's like, okay, deep breath. Here we go. It's 1 a.m, but I go to bed at 4 anyway. So let's work on this, you know, until it's done. And that's about how it goes. I like to do it. Slowly coming up on the, wait a minute, there might be too much going on here.
Trying to like balance time for everything that we do is the most challenging part of the job.
That's for sure.
There's so much that needs to be done on a daily and weekly basis. It's just incredibly challenging, but I feel like we're getting a little better at it, and you know, just keep shooting for the goal.
So, Drew, you've been pretty quiet tonight.
Well, I mean, it's about these two, you know.
That's true. Usually, at this point in an interview recording, I try to open it up to people who are on the show. He says any topics that we didn't talk about, or things you want to ask about, or anything that we didn't cover that you need to or want to bring up.
Well, in coming into this, I told you guys before I told all of you before we started, I was a little nervous.
Do you feel nervous now?
No, not at all.
Good.
I figured it was going to be a little bit more about, like the business aspect of everything, and less about, you know, let's talk about some sweet events that we do and, you know, what's coming up, that sort of stuff. So, I don't know. I'm pretty pleased with how things went. I feel like there's like, so much more that we could have talked about.
You know what that means, don't you?
Yeah, you know, I was sort of thinking about this, and before coming, I was like, oh, I don't know how I'm gonna like this. I don't know if I'm gonna be into it. But about halfway through, I was like, you know, we're definitely gonna have to get together again sometime and talk about everything that we didn't talk about, which is a lot.
We've got. I feel like we're getting better at a lot of things. And one of the things that I feel like that there's been some distinct improvements on, as far as our stores are considered is magic. Micah Greenbaum has joined the Battleground team recently, and he's been a really big, help on getting us, organized and heading in the right direction for what we want to offer to the magic community. And you know, one of the things that we're always, if any of your listeners are picking up on any of this stuff, like we love getting ideas. One thing that I'd want to put out to everybody that like, here's this, that's a regular or thinking about becoming a regular or, anybody that's up for just making a trip out to a good game store. It's like, it's ideas for things that they'd like to see. We definitely, you know, love hearing opinions from people on, what they'd like to see, what we could do better. You know, we want to provide a space for everybody that is good for everybody, you know, so, getting some feedback from people would be great. And you can, you know, contact Chase or I through the Battleground website. There's a link.
What would that
there.
Website be?
It would be www.battlegroundgames.com. We've got a very active message board there, with, you know, lots of busyness in, pretty much every category. You know, anybody can feel free to make any posts, suggestions, contact us through that. That's the kind of stuff that's just going to help us be a better company. So,
and how would people find you physically?
Chase and I put in plenty of hours at both locations. You'll tend to find me obviously more in Abington,
mm-hmm.
Chase is at Plainville quite a bit. So, I mean, any given day of the week, you could probably find us at either of those locations. But yeah, that's something I'd definitely like to hear some feedback from people on what they'd like to see. Yeah.
Very good.
Well, I'll give each other a thumbs up. Yeah. So I think that signals that we're probably done chatting for the evening.
All right.
I want to thank everyone involved for taking the time to come and do this and get together and have a chat.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it.
It was a good time.
So thank you everyone for listening and see you next time. Thanks.
See you at the game store.
Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon and all of the other podcasts that you know and love. Or you can always stream and download the latest episode of Wargaming Recon by heading on over to the show notes for that episode.
Hey there, this is Ben Gerber from Troll in the Corner, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my podcast, Indie Talks. Indie Talks is a discussion about independent publishing, where we take a look at indie games, the people who write them, and the people who play them. We're going to branch a little farther afield as well and talk to some independent television and movie stars and creators, as well as crafters, all of who are related to gaming in some way, shape, or form. So please join me on the Troll in the Corner Network at trollitc.com and give Indie Talks a listen.
Geeks Explicitly, new episodes coming at you every Thursday, talking about geek life. If you don't listen to Geeks Explicitly, then only at trollitc.com.
This is Andreas, Apprentice of the White Order. I would like to invite you to listen to my letters, a humble collection of my observations of the various beautiful and very, very dangerous creatures that inhabit my world. I hope you enjoy it as part of the Monsters of the Shattered World on Troll in the Corner at trollitc.com.
Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network. Visit www.trollitc.com for more information. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. Look for Wargaming Recon online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Stitcher Radio. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.
If you heard it and you do like it, good. If you don't like it, what I'm supposed to do.